This is VOA News. I'm Laurel Bowman. The death toll from the coronavirus outbreak has surpassed that of the SARS epidemic, according to data from Chinese authorities. This as millions of Chinese prepare to return to work on Monday. Reuters' Emer McCarthy reports.
The death toll from the coronavirus outbreak has now surpassed the SARS epidemic in 2002 and 2003, after China on Sunday announced a new daily record number of deaths. Data from the National Health Commission showed 89 deaths on Saturday, pushing coronavirus deaths well above the 774 who died from SARS. That grim milestone comes as millions of Chinese people prepared to return to work on Monday. Authorities extended a Lunar New Year break by 10 days as deaths and infections rose, and many of China's usually teeming cities have become ghost towns over the past 2 weeks. Even on Monday, a large number of businesses will stay shut, with many white-collar employees working from home. Among the new deaths on Saturday was an American hospitalized in the central city of Wuhan, where the outbreak began. He's the first confirmed non-Chinese victim of the disease, which has spread to 27 countries and regions, according to official reports.
That was Emer McCarthy reporting for Reuters. Terrified residents of a northeastern Thai city have been reliving their ordeal after a gunman went on a shopping center shooting spree that left 29 people dead before he was killed by Thai security forces. The Prime Minister of Thailand on his troops' use of force.
Yesterday I was worried about the use of force. It has to gradually go from light to heavy use of force, and measures taken has to be appropriate. That is most important because there were a lot of people present.
This is VOA News. With the Iowa caucuses behind them, Democratic presidential hopefuls head to the state of New Hampshire for a primary there on Tuesday. Sunday, on the ABC News show This Week, Democratic presidential candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden admits the odds are against him winning the New Hampshire primary. That's with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the race. This from Biden.
Let's be realistic. I think it's always going to be an uphill fight. When you're running against two people who are neighboring senators, you know the deal. Bernie won here, the neighboring senator, by 20 points last time. So I think it is an uphill fight, but I think it's a fight we'll do well in.
Also on ABC's This Week, Democratic presidential candidate and Senator Elizabeth Warren says she's not taking campaign donations from billionaires because she doesn't want to give them a bigger voice in our democracy.
Billionaires? They may own more shoes than the rest of us. They may own more cars. They may own more houses. But they shouldn't own a bigger piece of our democracy. And so long as they can do that, that's how it is that the things we want to see get done don't get done.
The movie industry's biggest awards ceremony, the Oscars, is coming up. On Sunday, 9 films are in the running for the Academy Awards' biggest prize, Best Film. Insiders say the favorite to win is the World War I film 1917. Other strong contenders are the South Korean social satire Parasite and the sentimental Hollywood favorite Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That one was directed by Quentin Tarantino. The show will also include live performances by musicians going for Best Original Song, including Elton John, Randy Newman, and Billie Eilish. American fast food icon McDonald's is marking 30 years since first opening its doors in Moscow and Pushkin Square in the winter of 1990. It's an occasion that resonates deeply in the Soviet Union's transition from communism into Russia's current-day market economy. The opening was linked to market and democratic reforms under then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's policy of perestroika. The irony, this slice of supposed Americana was, in fact, Canadian. This detail that helped smooth the deal with the Soviet authorities. For more on this and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com and check us out on mobile. I'm Laurel Bowman, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
To communities will be able to know the results of the council elections in under literally 3 days. And for the parliamentary elections, they have a maximum of 20 days, not more than 20 days for the Constitutional Council to give results.
Cameroonians vote to choose their lawmakers and local representatives Sunday.
The separation of powers in this state has been consolidated so that the judiciary carries out its responsibilities without any recourse to the state executive arm. So they are able to dispense justice in line with the constitution and in line with the expand clause of the state.
A Nigerian state governor calls on the judiciary to resist intimidation attempts from the other branches of government.
Quality that I have, and everything that I think I can unify the country and can unify the country and the club. So I think I won't hesitate if these are like the bad, if they have just apparently need to become an successor. I don't say if, as long as they have been elected, even but the only people have spoken, then I'll have to follow the instructions, and then whatever they will that they're willing to do, then I'll definitely be able to follow that.
And executives of the Lesotho ruling party meet Sunday to discuss candidates to replace Prime Minister Thomas Tabani. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Eno Abrams Egbe, chairperson for Elections Cameroon, or ELECAM, says his organization has implemented measures to ensure today's elections are credible. Cameroonians voted today in parliamentary and local elections. This, despite concerns of possible low voter turnout in the country's English-speaking areas due to the ongoing violence. For more on today's elections, I reach Eno Abrams Egbe, chairperson for Elections Cameroon, or ELECAM, in the capital, Yaoundé.
Before the launching of the campaign, 2 days before, we had a meeting with the stakeholders to finalize all the observations that can prop up. But don't forget that stakeholders is not a one occasion. As per the disposition of the electoral code, the stakeholders' concerns are taken care of 4 times a year during field trips of the board members. So at the national level, we have one of such prior to the elections, and this was done, and this permitted us to sign the code of good conduct with all the stakeholders, so everybody is set and everybody is aware of what is supposed to be done.
There are areas where there are concerns of possible attacks or disruptions and violence. Will elections be held in those areas? How do you intend to address this?
Well, one of those areas you're talking of is the northwest and the southwest, as is well known. I'm just coming back from the northwest region where I happen to cover the activities in that area. I can assure you now, at the moment I'm talking, all the materials are in the polling stations, and the same thing is in the southwest. Now, for security concerns, necessary dispositions have been put in place to permit voters to go freely, so we think that this issue has been taken care of. It's a security problem.
Some people held a series of demonstrations in Yaoundé and other parts of the country saying the election should be postponed because of some of the security challenges that you spoke about. Do you think their criticism that the elections will not be fair across the country because of the security concerns, you think their criticism is justified?
That is also democracy. People have a right to air their opinion. What is important is that they had their opinion, and they were allowed to do it, and people are prepared. Generally looking, the enthusiasm that is in the country now is that of people trying to renew the management team or the leadership. So people are very excited. But there are also people who don't want the elections for reasons which you have clearly exposed. That is their own concern. But nobody wants. We are only happy that no one was hurt, no security disposition. They allowed in. It means we are moving. We can only appreciate this type of a democratic nature that is building in our country.
You held a meeting
with observers who will be monitoring the elections. How did the meeting go? And did you share with them about your expectations and theirs as well?
The Director General of Elections who held the meeting. But globally, where such occasions take place, we call on the observers and give them valid and practical information on the ground, the number of polling stations, the number of the citizens that are going for as electors, and just practical modalities to get them across. And they should know beforehand what they are expected to do in the field, so they should not go astray. That is the reason for that meeting.
How credible do you think this elections will be?
Thank you very much. I think there are credible factors that can be substantiated here. First of all, registration went on with all the stakeholders. We know that this is our system. And the different commissions that have been put up in collaboration with all the stakeholders. Don't forget that the consultation forum is a moment where we square certain difficulties and come in consensus. And exceptionally for the twin elections, an effort was done to aerate the system. For each political party is going to have two candidates, two representatives in the polling stations. That will be one for the military and one for the parliamentary seat and one for the council seats. This gives a lot of surveillance and permits all the stakeholders on the ground to follow up. And don't forget, credibility also goes with accreditations. We have a good number of observers that have come and have the latitude to go wherever they are. So I think globally, everybody, all hands have been put on board to make things work. So I think there's total credibility in our system.
So how soon will Cameroonians know the outcome of Sunday's elections?
Well, the disposition of the electoral code states that 20 days is the maximum within the period where the Constitutional Council will give the results for the parliamentary elections. And for the council elections, we have barely 3 days. So Cameroonians will be able to know the results of the council elections in under actually 3 days. And for the parliamentary elections, we have a maximum of 20 days. Not more than 20 days for the Constitutional Council to give results.
Eno Abrahams Egbe is the chairperson for Elections Cameroon, or ELECAM. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The governor of Rivers State has called on the Nigerian judiciary to discharge its duties in accordance with the law, without fear or intimidation from the other arms of the government. Nyesom Wike, who is also a lawyer, says there's need for the judiciary to defend itself from attacks and criticisms from the other branches of the government. His comments come as the judiciary faces criticisms for allegedly dispensing judgment in favor of the highest bidder and in some cases succumbing to political pressure, accusations officials of the judiciary deny. For more about the call on the judiciary, I read Simon Nwakaudu, spokesperson for River State's Governor Nyesom Wike.
What the governor was saying precisely was that most officials of the executive and the lawmakers try very hard to put down the judiciary. They try very hard, you know, to intimidate the judiciary, make very outlandish allegations against the judiciary, claiming that the judiciary is corrupt, and you know, try to blame the judiciary for the problems of the country. The governor is saying precisely that the judiciary has discharged its responsibilities according to the constitution, that they've worked in line with the law, and they've done very well for the country, that they've performed far better than the executive and the legislative arms of government, that they should not allow themselves, you know, to be intimidated. And what we're saying is that the judiciary should rise up and defend themselves and not allow anybody to intimidate them as they discharge their duties.
Is the governor saying that there have been instances where the officials of the judiciary have been intimidated by the other arms of government in Nigeria? And what does he think is the best way to ensure that such intimidations or political pressure is not brought to bear in the judgment or the ruling, or for them to dispense justice?
The governor mentioned the issue of using the EFCC, Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, to intimidate members of the judiciary, especially from the executive arm of government. And he said that members of the judiciary should not allow anybody to, you know, bring the allegations that we have seen this amount in your account. Don't allow that to you know, discourage you from applying the law clearly the way it should be applied. And if you remember, sometime in 2016, members of the judiciary were arrested indiscriminately. It took the bold intervention of the governor very early one morning, and I think around October 2016, he stopped some members of the DSS from arresting a particular judge. We didn't know the judge at that time. We didn't know who the judge was, but the governor got information that some persons were trying to invade the residence of that particular judge then, and he went there, stopped that ugly episode.
But what do you say to critics who say that members of the judiciary have on occasions been proven to be corrupt themselves, and that is why they are susceptible to political pressures and, in some instances, intimidation by those who have dirt on them?
No, but the situation is, if anybody is proven to be corrupt, there are laid down procedures of handling such a situation. But a situation where somebody uses his position as member of the executive or the legislative arm, you know, to mount pressure on the judiciary, that's what the governor is saying. He's not saying that issues of corruption should not be tackled.
Some people have asked what the governor is doing in his own capacity to help strengthen the judiciary in his state and, by extension, the federation, and to help educate the masses about their rights and their responsibilities.
Yes, like this particular declaration that he made over the weekend is part of the process of educating members of the public. But most importantly, the governor is setting a template to ensure that members of the judiciary are not tempted to be corrupt. In River State, for instance, we've completed the judges' quarters. We have judges who are serving under the River State judiciary. At the completion of their time of service, we retire with houses built by the River State government. Unlike the situation in the past where someone will retire and will not have a place to lay his head. But in this situation, that has been finished. And the government has also instituted an owner-occupier system whereby some judges who are residing in specific government quarters will retire with such accommodation. And there is also financial autonomy for the state judiciary. And the state judiciary is operating on its own, you know, to carry out its function without any interference. The separation of powers in this state has been consolidated so that the judiciary carries out its responsibilities without any recourse to the state executive arm. So they are able to dispense justice in line with the Constitution and in line with the expand clause of the state.
Simon Wakaudu is the spokesperson for the Nigerian River State Governor, Nyesom Wike. He spoke with me from Port Harcourt. The leader of the Guinean Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party has rejected calls for a dialogue with the government over plans for a referendum to amend the constitution. Sidi Ature says the constitutional amendment plan will enable President Alpha Conde to seek additional terms in office, which he says contravenes the constitution. His remarks come after local media reports quoted U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's Twitter post expressing concern about plans by the Guinean administration to organize legislative election and constitutional referendum on March 1. Sidi Ature tells me opposition and civil society groups reject any dialogue which will enable President Conde to violate the constitution.
So we don't want to dialogue about the fact Alpha Conde can stay in power for a third term. There is no dialogue about that. The only thing we have to decide today is to be sure that the electoral list represented us. We have 8 million and a half voters among a 12 million population. That's about 70%. We never see something anywhere. Well, concerning Alpha is to say, I'm going straight on. That can be the problem around, I'm going straight on. So, I don't know. If you have a dialogue about the electoral list, okay, but we're not going to open a negotiation about a third term because the constitution is absolutely clear about that.
People have expressed concern about the referendum. If you don't hold the dialogue with the government to ease the ongoing tension in the country, then what's the best solution forward?
No, we can open a dialogue about the process of election. We can open a dialogue, but we have 8 million people in the restricted our electoral list. We can open that to be sure, but we will have the electoral list for Gill. How you can imagine that last election, we have 3 million voters, and we have an audit about that. We'll say what are more than a million people who not nobody knows where come from. After that, you say, I'm going to show you a new electoral list is 8 million and a half. So we can discuss about that. But as I say, the only thing we don't want to discuss is no third term. No third term.
Are the opposition parties and civil society organizations engaging the international community about some of these concerns you are raising?
Well, they just said, and you know, we met everybody, you know, special representative, UN secretary, and we have words released from the United States, from economical concern, I would say, UEA, and so.
What was the feedback that you got from them about the referendum?
Nobody agree about the referendum. This thing is illegal. It's not acceptable. You finish your second term, we stop now. If you want to discuss about how to organize the, you know, the electoral process, we're ready for that.
So what's next in this process as the government is considering bringing up the referendum this year?
So we will impeach. We'll have people around the country. We will impeach that. Maybe we'll see what happens. But we, for us, civil society and political party, this is something absolutely inacceptable. Absolutely not acceptable.
Sidi Ature is the leader of the Guinean Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. He spoke with me from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan. Executive members of the Lesotho ruling All Basotho Convention, or ABC, are discussing names of possible replacement for Prime Minister Thomas Thabane. Fako Moshoeshoe, chairperson of the ruling All Basotho Convention Party, or ABC caucus in Parliament, says the executives will ask the Prime Minister to give the date he plans to step down to help with efforts to ensure a smooth transition. To learn more about the candidate being considered to replace the Prime Minister, I read Fako Moshoeshoe, chairperson of the ruling All Basotho Convention Party caucus in Parliament.
That will be discussing the name that will be the one that will be successor of the Prime Minister when the Prime Minister retires.
But do you know when the Prime Minister is going to retire? Because so far he has yet to specifically say when he is going to retire.
Yes. Another thing that we are thinking, it will be one of the key issues, then he has to tell us when is he resigning. He should give us the date and everything. I think by tomorrow we will be taking the date at least. When is he prepared to resign?
Some people are saying that his decision of the date that he will retire ensure a smooth transition from him to the new prime minister. What are your views as a leader of parliamentarians or majority parliamentarians?
Exactly. According to the section 152 of the constitution, he has to resign formally to give the king the letter, and after giving him the letter of resignation, definitely the king will ask him to vote until the parliament has given the king the name who will be the successor. Then after that, after the parliament has given the king, after the parliament has given the king the name of the successor, then he stepped down.
Some people are suggesting that due to the alleged rift initially reported within the ABC ranks, there should be a compromise candidate that executives will be comfortable with. Is this what you are considering?
Actually, I can't say anything before we end up becoming one word so that we can be together, because that's the main thing that we're supposed to do. In fact, by now, I think it would be very premature to talk about that and stuff like that. So we are going to sit down and discuss each and every issue until we are clear, each and everything, so that we can go to the parliament united.
So let me ask you, Faku, personally, as a leader in parliament, what are the unique qualities you look for in a prime minister to replace Dr. Thomas Thabane?
Yes, I think we need someone who has got a charismatic, someone who is very disciplined, someone who is not a bit involved in any corruption, someone who is not with Basotho, someone who is not the ABC of the party as well. I think we are looking for such a candidate like that one. I think by tomorrow we'll be knowing that that candidate with all the qualities and everything that we think we're going to all reinstate all the dignity of the country as we see how things are unfolding nowadays in the country.
So what should the people of Lesotho expect from the leader that you will agree on that would meet their aspiration and address the challenging needs of the country?
Actually, what I would like to say is that as long as Basotho, according to the aspiration and then the social needs, and even in fact, the person that they don't think that this person is the right person, so that he can take us from here to another level, so that we can unite the city and unite Basotho, unite the political party as well. So that's what I'm saying. You're looking for a unifying sector as the one who will rescue us from this kind of situation which you are.
So, Fako, if the National Executive Committee of all the ABC decides that you are the person they are looking for, what will be your reaction?
Definitely, if they are convinced with the quality that I have and everything that they think I can unify Lesotho and can unify Basotho and so I think I won't hesitate if things are like that. But if they have just appointing to become a successor, I don't say as long as they have been elected, even the people have spoken, then I'll have to follow the instructions, and then whatever the will that they're willing to do, then I'll definitely have to follow that.
Fako Mashoeshoe is the chairperson of the Lesotho ruling or Basotho Convention Party caucus in Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Kofi Annan Commission on Elections and Democracy in the Digital Age just released a report which highlights the wide-ranging threats digital technologies poses to electoral integrity, as well as how democracies are pioneering ways to manage these threats and harness the opportunities. The commission worked globally with focus on African countries, including Kenya, Nigeria, and Cote d'Ivoire. Viewers Lino Modu spoke to Alan Dawes, president of the Kofi Annan Foundation, to discuss some of the key findings of the report.
Well, I think there are a number of threats. The first is that the elections may be manipulated or distorted by interference, either domestically or from abroad, with the way people vote, but also in terms of either helping to suppress their votes by discouraging them from turning up, or by distorting reality, and even worse, by spreading hate speech and disinformation. This has always been there to some extent. After all, newspapers also print lies. But with the advent of digital technology, all of that is being amplified very greatly by the speed by which information is transmitted and by the failure to be able to fact-check this information before it goes live and before it gets spread around the world. And that's very dangerous.
And would you please highlight a few of the key findings?
Well, first is that countries that are most vulnerable to online propaganda and disinformation are those where there is already polarization, where it's existed for some time and where it's very high and where trust is low, and even where traditional media, newspapers, TV and radio and so forth are all already highly partisan. Countries that fall into that category are particularly vulnerable to the kind of manipulation that can occur through social media and the internet. A second important finding was that it's clear that social media doesn't necessarily create the so-called echo chambers and filter bubbles, but as I said, it can certainly make it worse. It needs to take a step back and take stock of its role in creating the polarization. We believe that governments also need to take a lead in regulating, for example, political advertising. We don't believe it should be left to social media platforms alone. And they've done that already very responsibly in some areas, for example, in the area of terrorism and terrorism propaganda, but also in dealing with very sensitive issues such as child endangerment. So they've come up with their own good codes of conduct, and we'd like to see that extended. I should end, though, with a positive note. It's not all bad. We know that the internet, for example, has helped small political parties to get started and movements, social movements. It's also helped to improve their funding prospects. And that has helped to change the political landscape and helped to make it more participatory.
Now, the commission worked globally with a strong focus on Africa. What did you find most significant as you looked at some of the case studies on the continent?
Well, Africa is a democratizing continent. There's been big progress in recent years in areas like West Africa, where just about all countries now have gone through democratic elections, and where there's been renewal of governments, changes of government from party to party, like we saw in Nigeria. Nevertheless, Africa is particularly vulnerable to electoral interference, both by foreign countries and foreign companies and domestic interests, because institutional infrastructure isn't as strong as we would like it to be. Internet technology, actually, it's a positive point, has spread very, very rapidly throughout the continent.
Alan Dawes is the president of the Kofi Annan Foundation. He spoke with viewers Lenore Modu from Geneva, Switzerland. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, on Friday, Botswana held its first auction for elephant hunting rights since lifting a five-year hunting ban. Conservationists have criticized the move, but authorities in Habaroni argue the development is meant to benefit local communities. For VOA, Nkotisi Ndube reports from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
Botswana is the world's largest elephant population with more than 130,000. The growth of the population prompted the Southern African nation's government to lift a five-year hunting ban last May. This week, officials held an auction for seven hunting packages. Each package entitles the buyer to hunt and kill 10 elephants during the 2020 hunting season from April to September. A company known as Auction 8, which operated the sale on behalf of the government, said the auction Friday had gone well as six of the seven packages were sold. Reporters were not allowed to watch, but the auctioneer told VOA the event brought in a total of $250,000. Local professional hunter Randy Mutsumi welcomed the auction. He says hunters were left jobless after the 2014 decision to ban trophy hunting.
I am very much excited, more so that the hunting ban came without consultations. You can know the feeling of losing a job without the government telling you that you are going to lose the job. So I am very excited to get my job back, not me only, in and other communities, community people there. Will survive from this whole thing.
Neil Fitt of the Kalahari Conservation Society said the number of auctioned elephants were not too significant.
The numbers of animals which are up for sale through the auction, in my opinion, will not damage the viability of our elephant population in Botswana. We're talking about 70 compared to plus minus 130,000.
He added there is need for a code of conduct for professional hunters to avoid incidents such as the shooting of a monitored collared elephant last year.
We definitely need a proper and up-to-date 21st century code of ethics for the hunting fraternity. That includes the professional hunters to get them to sign up to a fairly heavy code of conduct to make sure that we don't have abuse and or, yeah, different incidents like we've had one last year.
Other conservationists have criticized the auction, saying Africa's once thriving elephant population has dropped far too low after years of excessive hunting and poaching. But Botswana says the decision to reintroduce trophy hunting is to reduce human wildlife conflict and also ensure communities benefit from wildlife resources. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
A It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, holders Esperance of Tunisia have drawn Zamalek of Egypt in the quarterfinals of this year's Africa Champions League, with a repeat of last season's controversial final against Wydad Casablanca possible. Zamalek and Esperance will also meet in the Africa Super Cup in Qatar this Friday, February 14th. The first leg of the quarterfinals will be played on 28th and 29th February, with the return legs set for a week later. The Africa Confederation Cup draw was also made in Cairo on Wednesday. In the African Champions League, record 8 times winners Al Ahly of Egypt will host the 2016 champions Mamelodi Sundowns from South Africa in the first leg of their tie. Raja Casablanca of Morocco, who won the last of their 3 titles in 1999, host DR Congo's TP Mazembe, who have won the title 5 times. Another Moroccan club, Wydad Casablanca, will face Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel winners in 2007. The semi-final draw was also made and has thrown up the possibility of another final between Esperance and Wydad Casablanca. Last year's climax to Africa's elite club competition ended in controversy. Esperance were awarded the title after Wydad left the pitch when an equalizer they scored was disallowed. Esperance were leading 1-0 in the second leg at the time and 2-1 overall. Either Raja or Mazembe will face Zamalek or Esperance in the first semi-final, with Wydad or Etoile drawing Ahly or Sundowns in the other. And in the Confederation Cup draw, Libyan side Al Nasra, who have qualified despite not having a league to play in at the moment, will meet Hassania Agadir of Morocco. Zambia Zanaco will take on Pyramids of Egypt, whose compatriots Al Masri meet last year's runners-up Renaissance Bakane of Morocco. Nigeria's Enyimba face Guinea's Horoya in ties to be started later this month. The two-legged quarterfinals are set for March 1st, with return legs a week later. The semifinals, which will also be played over two legs, will take place in May after the African Nations Championship CHAN. None of the sides left in African football's second-tier competition have ever lifted the trophy. This year, for the first time, Africa's Continental Club Finals will be a single match, with the Champions League final set for May 29th and the Confederation Cup the previous weekend. The venues for both matches have yet to be announced. Elsewhere, football's world governing body FIFA is to investigate a host of financial transactions carried out by CAF following an audit into the continent's ruling body. In a statement, a joint CAF-FIFA task force says more information is necessary and recommends further investigations into several areas, including CAF's dealings with French company Tactical Steel. The 2017 deal with Tactical Steel was notable as CAF cancelled an order worth just under $250,000 with sportswear company Puma to take up an alternative order costing 4 times as much with Tactical Steel, a company with links to a close associate of CAF President Ahmed. The task force recommendations come after FIFA Secretary General Fatima Samora's 6-month tenure as General Delegate for Africa ended earlier this month. Samora was appointed to the role last August in a bid to help improve the governance of African football. Finally, Nike has launched a mass market version of its controversial Alphafly prototype shoe that it says complies with the new World Athletics rules. On Friday, the sports governing body introduced an indefinite ban on any shoes that have a sole thicker than 40 millimeters or more than one rigid embedded plate or blade. The prototype shoes worn by Eliud Kipchoge when the Kenyan became the first athlete to run a marathon in under 2 hours in October do not meet these restrictions. But Nike says the retail version of the Zoom Alphafly set to go on sale this summer will do. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. Now, let's let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At long last, we have been able to learn of the results of the appeal to the Constitutional Court in Malawi following the presidential, local, and parliamentary elections of June 9, 2019. The results came not so much as a surprise because a few weeks earlier, there were reports that someone had been caught trying to bribe some judges of the Constitutional Court. The court ruled that because of irregularities and other matters, that the elections should be replayed. That is, it is annulled, and that new elections should be held within 150 days. The court also suggested that the head of the election commission should be set aside. It may be called also that one of the demands made by the opposition forces after they had submitted their appeal to the Constitutional Court was the immediate resignation of the head of the Electoral Commission. She had refused to do so. Now, we have heard reports that President Peter Mutharika of Malawi and the head of the Electoral Commission have submitted an appeal to the Supreme Court charging that the decision of the Constitutional Court had gone against democracy. There has been no clear sense yet as to whether President Mutharika and the head of the Electoral Commission were asking for a stay of the decision of the Constitutional Court. Some of the people in the opposition had felt that it would be difficult for the government to appeal a unanimous decision of the Constitutional Court. And in that sense, they were planning that the former vice president, who was himself a candidate in the election, should return to his post. Until there is clarification on this matter, there will be a cloud as to what would happen next. For example, some parliamentarians that lost their seats in May 1919 are now arguing that in light of the decision of the Constitutional Court, they should resume their seat in Parliament, awaiting the result of the Supreme Court. Some in the opposition parties have said that it is wrong for President Mutharika to appeal to the Supreme Court, given the fact that it was a unanimous opinion. But this is neither here nor there. The opposition parties have sought release in the Constitutional Court because they felt they had some injury from the election based on the result of the Electoral Commission. And it is fair that President Mutharika and his party, as well as the head of the Electoral Commission, should also seek remedy from the Supreme Court. This, of course, is not the first time in Africa that court had annulled a national election. Kenya had it, and when that happened, the entire global community hailed it as something good for democracy. But in the end, we knew what happened in Kenya. There was controversy as to what terms should be for the rerun of the election. And things were so controversial that the opposition party in Kenya did not participate. And in the end, the incumbent, President Kenyatta, was returned to office. So let us hope that this does not happen in Malawi, and there should be more clarification as to whether there is a stay of the decision of the Constitutional Court or whether the Supreme Court will hear the case laid before it by President Mutharika and the head of the Electoral Commission. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Soti Soul with Susanna, Yemi Alade featuring Angelique Kidjo with Shekere will be next. And then Khalid featuring Pitbull with Iya Iya. And then Nina Rose ends it all with Munda Dala.
I hope you're happy now. I see you change your skin color. And your hair is longer now. Now to walk now, baby. I'm no candle, I'm Champs-Élysées. Who can test on a camini? Yeah, 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 yeah. None of my business. And I see you with Hana. Silicon on your palm. Shaking what you done to give ya. On your worst behavior. Chamina dua I send Jacqueline moyoni bado wewe nizuzua. When are you coming home, Senje? Tell me, are you on your way? Kipe tukipenda na Kiromeo na Julia. I send na koso singi sisi kuku chamina dua. I send Jacqueline moyoni bado wewe nizuzua. When are you coming home, Senje? Tell me, are you on your way? Kipenda na Kiromeo na Julia I send the banner send it. Hello, hello, hello,
hello, hello.
If you get to hear this song, somebody loves you.
Hey, hey.
Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Nelson Lopez. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an old woman feels uneasy when dry bones are mentioned in a proverb. I'm your host, Peter Clotin in Washington. Good evening, Africa.